I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, another in our occasional series, Midday on Higher Education, in which we sit down with the presidents of colleges and universities throughout the state. Among the nation's largest metropolitan areas, Greater Baltimore is the fourth most educated region in America. 17% of area residents hold advanced or professional degrees, many of them from Maryland's only public health, law, and human services university, the University of Maryland, Baltimore. My guest today is the president of UMB, Dr. Jay Perman. Dr. Perman is a practicing physician who has helped UMB become a biotech innovator with a strong commitment to the West Baltimore neighborhoods just beyond its downtown campus. Dr. Jay Perman joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today, it's another in our occasional series, Midday on Higher Education. From time to time, I sit down with the presidents of Maryland colleges and universities to talk about the challenges that each of their institutions face and how those institutions are connected to the fabric of the communities in which they are located. Over the past few months, I've spoken with Maria Thompson of Coppin State University, Jose Antonio Bowen of Goucher College, and Father Brian Linnane, the president of Loyola University, Maryland. Today, my guest is Dr. Jay Perman, the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore. Dr. Perman is a pediatric gastroenterologist. He was chair of the Department of Pediatrics at UMB's School of Medicine for 5 years before moving to Kentucky, where he was dean and vice president for clinical affairs at the University of Kentucky College of Medicine. He returned to Baltimore in 2010 to become UMB's sixth president. Dr. Perman also chairs the Downtown Partnership of Baltimore. UMB has about 6,700 students in six professional schools that include schools of dentistry, law, medicine, nursing, pharmacy, and social work, plus an interdisciplinary graduate school. Its biopark employs about 1,000 scientists and entrepreneurs who work on developing new drugs and treatments and medical devices. We'll take your calls a little later in the program for Jay Perman. In the meantime, if you'd like to drop us an email, our address is midday@wipr.org. You can always reach us by Twitter as well, @MiddayWIPR. And we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page, so you're welcome to ping us on Facebook. Dr. Perman, it's good to meet you, sir. Thanks for coming in.
Tom, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I wonder if we could start by explaining something that's a little confusing to me, and that is the relationship between the University of Maryland, Baltimore, and the University of Maryland medical system, because the medical school is part of the university you run, but the medical hospital, I guess, and the various hospitals that they run are not. Do I have that right? What's the relationship?
You do have it right, and let me just comment on a bit of history. Once upon a time, the medical center, which was the founding member of the medical system, was part of the university. And in 1984, our state legislature recognized that a medical center that is part of a university might not fare well in the rugged world of the hospital industry. Highly regulated industry in itself, but also an industry that is very competitive, even though most of these organizations are not for profit. And so at that time, the medical center, and I don't know if this is the correct word, this is the way a physician talks, was spun out of the university and allowed it to become a private entity so that it could thrive and complete its mission to the citizens of Maryland as essentially an equal to the private hospital institutions.
Now, and it's a private entity, but it's still a nonprofit.
It's absolutely a nonprofit, and the governor appoints the board. And over these years, the medical system has thrived. As a practicing physician in the medical center, I am very proud of, first of all, the privilege that I have to practice within the medical center, but I'm also proud of the healthcare delivery that is so much a part and such a shining example of excellent healthcare delivery. So I think the intent has been very good, and I can tell you that my colleagues on the board, on which I sit as an ex officio non-voting member simply by virtue of my position, not because I'm Jay Perman, I'm very proud of those colleague medical board members because I know that they have worked very hard to ensure that the healthcare we deliver is excellent.
So by merit of the fact that you are the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore, you are automatically on the board of the University of Maryland Medical System.
That is correct. Thing.
But the medical school, the University of Maryland Medical School, is run by you, right?
It's run by me as part of the university.
And, of course, the University of Maryland Medical System Board has been under quite a bit of scrutiny for the past 4 or 5 days. Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun broke a story last Thursday, I believe, in which it was noted that 9 members of the University of Maryland Medical System Board, not including you, 9 members, but members which did include Mayor Catherine Pugh, were receiving financial benefit, financial compensation for services they were providing to the medical system. What can you tell us about that?
Very little, and not because I don't want to. Those are matters that I think were matters of course. My understanding is that everything that was done is legal, but I think that we have not had a chance to come together again as a board so that I can learn more. And therefore, I can't be as responsive to you as I might otherwise be.
Was it known to you and the other members of the board that the University of Maryland Medical System had contracts with, you know, one of the members who's an insurance provider, for example, and there's one of them who's a doctor who was providing some services. Mayor Pugh sold some 20,000 children's books that were distributed by the system to kids in the clinics, and I guess kids even in some of the Baltimore City public schools. Is that something that was, it was all disclosed? And we should mention, by the way, that Mayor Pugh has resigned from the board. She revised her disclosure forms last Friday, and then this morning issued a press release in which she said she submitted her resignation as a board member because she's busy with other things. So was this something that was, you know, that you and other members of the board were aware of, or was it just the executive leadership who knew about it?
I can only speak for myself. I was not aware. But then again, these day-to-day contracts, if you will, don't come before the governance board. So I don't know if this was an outlier, but to answer your question, I was not aware.
All right. Well, that is a story that is continuing. The governor has issued a very strong statement. He said it was unseemly and appalling that this was happening. So chances are pretty good that a bill from Senator Jill Carter will probably fare pretty well in this current session, and perhaps the rules around that will change. But the University of Maryland is still part of the name of the University of Maryland Medical System because of this legacy that they were involved with the actual university long ago. And even though they're separated financially in terms of the hospital and the university, the name remains part of it.
Yes, and I would tell you that we're very proud of the relationship that we have with the medical system. We're proud to have them wear our name. And I look forward to all of this being reconciled.
Is the relationship between the hospital and the medical school similar to that of Johns Hopkins University, where they have the hospital and the Johns Hopkins medical institutions, and they're involved in some way with the university system itself?
I don't think it's exactly the same.
Yeah, so there are variations.
Yeah, there are different models.
What does it mean to you that UMB is considered an anchor institution? We hear that term bandied about quite frequently, that the University of Maryland, Hopkins, two or three other corporations in town are referred to as anchor institutions. What's that mean to you?
Well, at its simplest, I think when people refer to anchor institutions like ourselves at Hopkins and Hopkins, they're referring to the fact that we're major employers, that we spend money in the city and in the state, so that we're in its simplest version, an economic force. But that's not enough, Tom. To me, and I've hoped that we could give meaning to this over these years at UMB, and I think we have done our job. It means caring about the community. It means using our resources, and I don't just mean money, because we use a lot of sweat equity, to be a member of the community, to be a partner with the community, so that the community of which we're a part, and our places in West Baltimore and downtown Baltimore, as you know, we can do our job the way people that are neighbors and share alike community do for the benefit of all in the community.
A year or so ago, you were one of the first people, more than a year ago, you were one of the first people to mention things like life expectancy and average median incomes for people in Harlem Park and Roland Park are dramatically different. A life expectancy of some 20 years lower for a person living in Harlem Park or Upton or Druid Heights, the neighborhoods that abut your campus. What is the capacity of the University of Maryland Baltimore to affect change in those neighborhoods and to affect raising the median income and raising the life expectancy?
Well, we have given a great deal of attention to what is called the social determinants of health. In other words, there are, as you point out, major discrepancies in life expectancy. So on the face of it, it becomes very easy for people to assume that this is all about discrepant health care, that if we could only deliver health care that is of high quality to all, we would close this gap. The fact of the matter is that we offer high-quality health care to our neighbors. So what's the difference? The difference, as some people have chosen to describe it, is your zip code. In other words, how much money you have, whether you have transportation, whether you have health literacy, the ability to manage multiple medications, whether you can get access to a very good healthcare system. These are the social determinants of health. So we've been focused, one's education. We've been focused on trying to make a healthier community, which doesn't mean simply providing better healthcare. We have to figure out how we can help in the matter of getting people jobs, in the matter of explaining to them how they manage 15 medications, in the matter of how they exercise, in their safety, et cetera. That will make a difference. That will close the gap, I believe.
We've talked on many occasions on this program with Lena Nguyen, who's the former health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. She's now the president of Planned Parenthood, so we haven't talked in a you know, several weeks. But we talked about the lack of access to health care for so many neighborhoods. So in those neighborhoods that are close to you downtown, you're off of Martin Luther King Boulevard on the west side. I mentioned Upton, Druid Heights, et cetera. When you say you provide health care, is it free? Is it accessible? I mean, what sort of insurance does someone need to have? Are these Medicaid patients? Are these patients who are indigent? Are these, what's your clientele?
Well, it's all of the above, but what I'm trying to articulate is the fact that what we bring to the neighborhoods are the following. You mentioned Lena Nguyen. In partnership with the health department and with so much on her part in the way of leadership, in our Promise Heights neighborhood, which is Upton Druid Heights, we developed a program called Be More for Healthy Babies. How do you get a healthy baby? How do you avoid prematurity? These are not that hard if one pays attention to providing health care to the expectant mom, some helping of folks in parenting in the first year of life. So, you know, about 10 years ago when this program started, the infant mortality rate, and infant mortality is the number of mortalities per 1,000 live births in the first year of life. And I will tell you that in Upton Druid Heights 10 years ago, the infant mortality was very similar to, frankly, some third world countries. And over the 10 years of Be More for Healthy Babies, we've gotten that number down considerably. The number of infants that die of sudden infant death in that community has come down significantly. So this is not so much a matter of getting people to the emergency room where we serve them or getting them to a clinic. It's a matter of taking a step before that and trying to avoid the morbidity and the mortality in the first place. That's the kind of approach we're taking.
And that includes stuff like social workers going into homes, you know, while the women are pregnant and, you know, giving them some advice about prenatal care, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's advice about prenatal care. It's advice after birth. These are, you know, it's almost maddening. These are simple interventions. They're interventions that don't cost what an infant requires in care in a neonatal intensive care unit over months after birth. They're simple. They're cost avoidance measures. They're the right way to approach things. In our community engagement center, we have our pharmacy students working with seniors who are on multiple medications. I wouldn't like to have to manage 15 different medications over the course of a day. I wouldn't know how to do it. And I have some medical knowledge. These are the things that we can do in order to avoid people needing to go for acute care in the first place. I could go on and on.
And we'll give you a chance to go on and on a little when we come back from a quick break. It's Midday on Higher Education. We'll have more with University of Maryland Baltimore President Dr. Jay Perman when we return after a break. When we do, you're welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email to midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page as well. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, Baltimore's new police commissioner, Michael Harrison, will join me for the hour. Commissioner Harrison was sworn in last week after winning the unanimous approval of the Baltimore City Council. He began working on an interim basis on the 11th of February. He'll be my guest tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, it's Midday on Higher Education. Dr. Jay Perman has been the president of the University of Maryland Baltimore since 2010. You're welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR, to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR, and we are also streaming our conversation on the WYPR Facebook page. So we have an email from Ashley on our Facebook ping, who says, what specifically are you doing for West Baltimore? We talked a little bit about healthcare access. I want you to also talk a little bit about a program called the CORE Scholars Program.
The CURE Scholars Program,
yeah.
Tom. And I'm delighted to have a chance to talk about it. And I thank the listener for her question. We have realized in healthcare education nationally that we're not creating, not because we don't want to, but we're not creating a workforce in healthcare that looks like the population of these United States, certainly not today and certainly not in what is projected. In other words, and speaking directly, we don't have sufficient physicians, dentists, for the most part, healthcare providers writ large, that adequately reflect the percentages of people of color in the population. And as important a matter of fairness and social justice as that is, it's plain and simple a matter of outcomes. The literature shows that when people are cared for by individuals that come from their life experience, their belief sets that look like them, they fare better with regard to outcomes. And really, that's what we're all after, good outcomes.
Why do you think that is? Do you think, because there are some who would say that Caucasian, you know, people, Eurocentric people are just less less attentive to people of color. Is that an explanation that you agree with?
Well, it's multifactorial. You know, part of this in terms of outcomes is genetic. Part of it is what one might call behavioral, both on the part of the provider and the patient. The fact of the matter is, and you bring up a very good point, that needs to be studied. And the folks that are most likely to be committed to research careers to studying them are people of the populations affected. So for that reasons, we stood up a program some 4 years ago with the support of the National Institute of Health and its National Cancer Institute to find children who we could encourage to healthcare careers, who we could help get there. There have been programs like this and are ongoing programs like this all over the country. They look for talented young people in late high school, early college, and they get some success. But our hypothesis was that for too many, it's too late.
That high school is too late.
That high school and late high school is too late. So we decided to be bold and start a program in sixth grade with the idea that we hold on to these children for dear life through sixth, seventh, eighth grade, and into high school. We're into the fourth year of that program. We have tremendous retention in the program, thanks not only to all of the mentors that come from our various schools and from the community, but also to the parents of these children who are totally committed to their success. I'll be in a rocking chair. I hope I'm still in a rocking chair when one of these kids walks across a graduation stage and becomes a physician. But you got to start somewhere, and we've decided to start young.
So what does that entail then? What is a sixth or seventh grader is part of this program, and she is then, strongly encouraged? In what ways is she strongly encouraged to pursue a career in biotech or medicine or research?
Tuesdays and Thursdays after school, come to campus, some mentoring with regard to homework. Saturdays, maybe come into the OR with some of our providers who come from that particular community. Summertime programming, all of the above in order to hold those students close to us and us to them.
We have an email from Michael who says, Dr. Perman and his staff should be congratulated for their work engaging the residents living around his campus. They're working hard to raise the quality of life. He personally makes himself available to resolve the mundane as well as tackling institutional cultural changes required to make a real difference. So Michael's giving you a high five. Chris emails, not so much. He says, at what point will the University of Maryland be large enough to stop their never-ending building and demolition of Baltimore history? They've been able to use the public dime to build its biopark and its downtown campus, using the city government to take property off the market and then bulldoze it and turn it over. So there is a tension when you are developing new buildings, new programs, new initiatives between the people who've lived in the neighborhood for a long time. I mean, certainly Hopkins had its share of critics on their project that they refer to as the EBDI over on the east side. You're on the west side. How do you address folks like Chris who has concerns?
Well, I appreciate Chris's concerns, but I would have to take issue with them. The biopark was built, I think, virtually entirely on vacant land. When I left in 2004 to go to the University of Kentucky, I remember glass-strewn lots. So where we built our biopark, there was nothing, and we did it with the community, and I think the community appreciates us for the public safety we add, but I'm not aware of any kind of extensive demolition that has made it possible for us to be part of the community.
In terms of economic ties of the university to the community, creating jobs and advancing economic development, not just of your buildings in your neighborhood, but as we talked about, what you referred to as Promise Heights, Upton, Druid Heights. What are the ways, what's the capacity that the university has to do that?
Well, in our community engagement center on Poppleton and Baltimore Street, we have Workforce Wednesdays. And on Workforce Wednesdays, anybody can come in, get help with their resume. If they qualify for an open job at the university or the medical center, we make sure that they get an interview. A number of our neighbors have benefited from that. If they don't qualify for something related to our particular work or are interested in something else, we hook them up with other agencies because we do care very much about workforce development. In fact, going all the way back to the kids and our CURE program, there are always jobs in healthcare. So in many ways, this is a workforce development effort for the future.
You talk about these programs, and they are plentiful and thought of very highly. As a person who has been in and out of this community for 30-something years, with so many of these kinds of interventions, with so many of these very good ideas about holistic approaches to poverty and to economic disenfranchisement and marginalization, why do you think the needle seems to move so slowly?
It's an excellent question. It concerns me. And I can tell you that my office happens to be high enough so that I can look out on West Baltimore. I can also look out at the downtown area. And I can tell you that people come over to the window and stand with me and say, with their hands wide open, this is impossible. And obviously, if we decide, all of us together, that this is impossible, then the outcome is assured. And it's not a very good outcome. We have to do things incrementally. I think we could all of us who are striving for a better Baltimore, working with the community, empowering the community, I think we have to do a better job of striving together. I think we can leverage each other better than we're leveraging each other, but we must not get discouraged.
Dr. Jay Perman is the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday on Higher Education. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR, and you can ping us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. One of the issues that the city faces, and it's an issue that, you know, large anchor institutions like yours and the University of Maryland writ large, down even in College Park, Johns Hopkins, the tax base is shrinking. The population is shrinking. I mean, we had a little bit of a bump 4 or 5 years ago. That's now headed the opposite direction. In the 1950s, at the time of Beth Steele and the sort of heyday of manufacturing, you know, we had more than 1 million residents. You know, in the 19th century, for generations, Baltimore was a larger city than New York. Those days are gone. And I wonder if the tax base can be reinvigorated by something like the biotech industry. I mean, is biotech the next Beth Steele, as it were? And is biotech, do you think, in your view, the way to go to bring in these kinds of jobs that just simply don't that pay good wages and that just don't seem to exist for so many folks in the community?
I don't think there's any question about it, Tom. I chair the governor's Life Science Advisory Board. This is a group of individuals from the private sector, from government, from the higher ed institutions, in order to grow the life science industry in Baltimore and in Maryland. It has been done in Boston. It's obviously been done in Silicon Valley. It's been done in the Research Triangle in North Carolina. It's certainly possible here in Baltimore. Our biopark is an example of this. It's a place where there are about 36 companies. They make about 1,000 jobs. That's why we're growing those facilities and at the same time educating people so that they can populate those jobs. But yes, that's where our opportunity is.
You assert on your website and in various publications that UMB graduates most of the doctors, the lawyers, the pharmacists, the dentists, and the social workers who are working here in Maryland. What is it? Are there specific initiatives or specific efforts on the part of your institution to keep those folks in Maryland? In other words, if they're educated here, what's to stop them from going to Boston or Silicon Valley or Atlanta or you name it?
Well, there's nothing to stop them. But first of all, we start, frankly, although I value our out-of-state students, with the fact that a good three-quarters of our students are Marylanders. So hopefully they've got some individual reason to be anchored in the community. We're working with students who, in addition to becoming those professional individuals, want to learn how to be entrepreneurs. And we're helping them to learn how to pitch. We're helping them to learn how to raise revenue. We're providing revenue to startups, all with the idea that we can hold them, hopefully, in Maryland. And I think we have a good track record in that regard.
There's been a proposal from folks in the financial sector here in Baltimore that institutions should be required to allocate a certain part of their endowment to this entrepreneurship that you just mentioned, the venture capital that would fund various ideas. The the upside of that's a lovely thing, and we're funding local businesses and we're giving young, smart people a chance to develop their ideas. The downside, of course, is that venture capital is a very risky business, and that for every great idea, there are maybe 10 or 20 really rotten ideas or ideas that seem great at the top of the top of the process and not so great when they finally fail. So given that risk, given your responsibility and obligation to make sure that your endowment doesn't lose money and, you know, exist to be able to fund the things you want to fund. What do you think about that idea of making it basically a requirement that Maryland and Hopkins and other large institutions determine that some of their endowment is going to always be invested in venture capital?
Well, I don't know that it needs to be a requirement. I can tell you that we're doing it with the approval of the University System of Maryland. We are risk-averse. We should be, and that's what the public should expect. This is not, by the way, with tax dollars, with the public's dollars. These are dollars that we attract in terms of philanthropy, but we can use some of our monies, and we're very careful about risk. We have an external advisory board that scrutinizes, just as a venture capitalist would scrutinize our investments. So we're getting into that without a requirement having to be made.
So you don't think a requirement is necessary?
Not for us.
Mm-hmm. Do you have some notion of how much, you know, a percentage of the endowment that's going into venture?
It's small, and I don't know it off the top of my head, but it's very small.
In terms of the research that's being done in the biopark, we're talking about new drugs, new treatment protocols, new devices, that sort of thing. There always seems to me, as a layperson on looking at this process from the outside, an inherent conflict, an inherent tension between who owns this intellectual property. Is it the individual researcher? If that researcher is working in a lab at UMB, is it UMB? Is it the public, if it's a publicly subsidized operation? How do you negotiate and navigate that? And as a researcher yourself and as a physician yourself and the president of this university, how do you understand that tension and what do you do about it?
Well, we understand it, I think, by working very hard to reduce the tension. In my day, when I was coming up, the notion of discovering something and then taking it to the market was almost something unseemly. And regrettably, we spent all of our time making sure that we published our findings, getting them into a scholarly journal, and maybe they would get picked up and make a difference to humanity or not. Now we're being more deliberate about that, and we're encouraging our investigators, when they have discoveries that can make a difference to the human condition, to get them into the marketplace. And the answer to your question as to who benefits, it's sort of all of the above. The individual investigator benefits if this is commercialized. The institution benefits. And the school from which that investigator arose benefits.
So there are rules about that sort of thing. There are
very
protocols
strict.
That say, okay, if this thing goes to market and becomes a big success and makes a lot of money,
it's all set down. Mm-hmm. It's all set down, and we're very careful about conflicts of interest.
Because I'm always hearing about lawsuits, not necessarily at UMB, but I've heard of, 10 or 20 physician friends of mine have said to me, you know, there's this problem, you know, that we developed something in the lab and then it got copyrighted or whatever, patented, whatever, and there's a big conflict and people are taking each other to court all the time. It seems to me to be something of a problem. You're saying it's not such a big deal?
I don't want to ignore problems, but I think we manage it correctly and very well.
Midday on Higher Education will continue in a little bit with UMB President Dr. Jay Perman. We're going to take a quick break. 410-662-8780 is our number. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday_WIPR. And we are also streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page. Before we take that break, on Mondays here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who've lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 58 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. Police now have identified two victims from the week before last. They are Thomas Braxton, age 50, and Taiwan Smith, age 18. Last week, 7 people lost their lives to violence in our city. Their names are Jawan Armstrong, age 33, Michael Davis, age 35, Theron Jones III, age 25, Mason Haley, age 27, Jeremy Thompson, age 21, Nicholas McPherson, age 25, and Taylor Davis. She was 18 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's Midday on Higher Education, an occasional series in which we sit down with leaders of colleges and universities throughout our state. Next month, former Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoke, the president of the University of Baltimore, will join me for the hour. My guest today is the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore, Dr. Jay Perman. If you have a question for Dr. Perman, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. To follow me on Twitter, again, it's @TomHallWIPR. And you can ping us on the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. You still practice medicine, Dr. Perman. You're a pediatric gastroenterologist, and you find yourself in the clinic from time to time. How is that important to you, and why is that important to you?
Well, thank you for the question, Tom. You are absolutely correct when you say it's terribly important to me. First of all, I've been practicing for more than 40 years. I think I can honestly look at you and your radio audience and say, I enjoy it as much today as I enjoyed it the first day I was allowed to do it. And that is because I've had the privilege to be among students. And it is also because I have the privilege of taking care of children. So every Tuesday afternoon, I go see patients. I see children with digestive diseases, such as abdominal pain and constipation, and children with liver diseases and poor nutrition. And I am joined by students from each one of the professional schools that you mentioned at the outset of the program. And why do I do that apart from the personal pleasure that I derive from having that privilege? I do it because I want our students who emanate from the University of Maryland, Baltimore, and take care of the folks from the state of Maryland, to understand the importance of practicing in a team. So I have social workers, dentists, nurses, physicians, pharmacists, dental hygienists, and lawyers. And, you know, when I talk about this around the country, I might point out that people say, okay, Perman, we get what you're doing, but what do you do with the law students? And that's a very important point because lawyers also often need to be a part of a healthcare team. Here in this city, we have still too many children who are affected by lead intoxication. Well, I know how to get the lead out of a child, but I'll tell you something, that should only be required once, because the rest of it is...
If the kid goes back to a home that's still
precisely,
got lead in the windows, et cetera.
What have you done? Mm-hmm. So one needs a lawyer to make sure that the property owner complies with the law.
So that whole notion of interdisciplinary treatment, as it were, for your patients, but also it's interdisciplinary habit on the part of the folks in the dentistry school and the pharmacology school and the medical school and the law school and social work. So is that a new trend? I mean, is this something, I mean, it used to be before, you know, you practice law and if something ails you, you go see the doctor, you know, and there were silos. Are you saying that those silos should be broken down and are beginning to break down? Is this the new way of practicing medicine, practicing law, practicing social work?
Well, a couple of comments. First of all, I'm ashamed to say that it's not a new wave in the sense that people have been talking about this since the early 1970s. But too much in our higher education milieu, we've still stayed in our silos. So in essence, it's not new, and yet it's finally coming to the fore. Now, why is it important that this happens? We talked earlier, Tom, about the social determinants of health. I think I'm reasonably good at making diagnosis and writing the proper prescription, but I don't know how to get the mold off somebody's wall and who you need to talk to do that or get the electricity turned on. And I don't know what a pharmacist knows about extraordinarily complex drug interactions. In too many situations, you need to have a team.
Student debt is something that a lot of folks cite as the next big U.S. crisis. You run professional schools. So these are folks who hold undergraduate degrees who are then furthering their education in specific fields. And it can be very costly. So even if you're getting out of school and you're a lawyer or you're a doctor, I mean, there are even cases where law students have sued their law schools because they haven't been able to find a job that begins to help them pay back what it costs them in tuition to attend law school. What's your perspective about the scope of the crisis, the severity of the crisis, and what can be done about it?
It's a crisis that we need to attend to, absolutely. You talk about professional students. First of all, they come to professional school carrying debt from their undergraduate years. And then even though our tuitions, as high as they are, don't even begin to pay the total cost of education, they graduate with enormous debt. A dentist over 200,000, physicians close to 200,000. And yes, everybody assumes these are well-paid occupations. They can pay it off. I'll give you a perspective. For a medical student who takes down $150,000 or $160,000 in debt, they get years to pay it off. But the payment, if you want to pay it off in 10 years, is about $2,400 a month on $150,000 in debt. That's, for a lot of people, a mortgage or more than a mortgage.
So what can be done about that?
Well, I think this requires some public attention. I think there's a great deal of understandable concern about underserved areas, both within our urban areas and rural America. And I think there needs to be given some greater thought given to debt relief. In other words, in exchange for your service, we'll help you pay off
so
your debt.
So you agree to work in an urban, downtown, impoverished neighborhood. You agree to work in a rural environment where they don't have access to doctors or lawyers.
And you'll get help. In exchange for years of service, you'll get help with your debt.
I've talked to a couple of the other folks who run some of the private colleges and universities around here, undergraduate courses in the main, and we talk about tuition creep, that, you know, and they say, well, you know, the tuition may be $60,000 a year or $50,000 a year to send a student. However, 90% of our students are on scholarship, so that's not really what people pay. And of course, my question is, well, why is the tuition set so high to begin with? Does that apply to the professional schools as well that you run?
Well, we provide a great deal of scholarship, but, and again, I know this is hard to believe, but the cost of educating a physician, for example, is much more per year than the tuition we charge.
We have a phone call from Noah in Baltimore. Noah, welcome to Midday with Dr. Jay Perman.
Hello, can you hear me?
Hi, yes, sir, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question for Dr. Perman. I know you oversee the entire university, which includes the School of Nursing. I'm wondering if you have any personal views on full practice authority for nurse practitioners and other advanced practice nurses.
All right, thanks for that question. So this is full practice authority for advanced practice nurses.
Well, as you know, Noah, progress has been made in the state with regard to scope of practice for nurse practitioners, whether they need an agreement with a physician as well. And I have to tell you, and I know this will not necessarily come out the way I mean it, but I say it with admiration. I have never practiced without a colleague nurse practitioner. So it comes back to the importance I attach to team. And what I worry about in these conversations about independent practice, et cetera, whether it's nurses or others, physicians, physician assistants, we want to make sure that the conversation doesn't become one of, I can do whatever you do just as well or better than you do, and much more conversation about how can we get the job done together.
I have to ask you about the School of Social Work at University of Maryland. From time to time, I get emails and assertions from people either at the school or recent graduates who assert a very serious argument about the School of Social Work, and they call it ongoing gender and race-based discrimination. And they say that they've filed multiple complaints and that those complaints have fallen on deaf ears. This is something that churns into my inbox with some regularity. We've never covered it as a story, but let me ask you to respond to those charges.
Well, we take those complaints very seriously, and I think great progress is being made. It's never fast enough for all of us, but I know that there is great progress being made on the part of the dean and the faculty with regard to addressing those complaints. What I do take issue with are some charges that have suggested that complaints come to the university and there's no mechanism for investigating them. That is simply untrue. We care about it very much. They are investigated. If the complaints are anonymous, it's very hard to get back to people, but we do take it seriously.
Does that indicate that, a review of some of the complaints, you found some merit? I mean, is this an issue that the School of Social Work really needs to zero in on and address?
I think higher education in general needs to do better with regard to these matters that are being raised. So the answer is yes.
Is diversity on your faculties, not just in the School of Social Work, but in all of the schools? You mentioned the paucity of people of color in the field of medicine, the field of law. Is that a challenge for you, attracting talent to be on the faculties of these various professional schools?
Yes, it is a challenge, and it's a challenge nationally. And I think so much of what we all do in higher education is try to attract from the other institutions rather than increasing the pool. That's the basis of programs like our UMB Cure program.
Dr. Jay Perman is the president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore. Dr. Perman, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow on Midday, Baltimore's new police commissioner, Michael Harrison, will join me for the hour, and I hope you can join us as well. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. And by the way, on Wednesday, we're going to talk to Michael Braverman. He's the housing commissioner of Baltimore City. We're going to talk about a very aggressive plan to demolish a number of vacant, blighted houses around the city. So tomorrow, the police commissioner, Michael Harrison. Wednesday, the housing commissioner, Michael Braverman, here on Midday. We want to thank the Diz for providing lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner. They serve breakfast on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. www.hearandnow.com. I'm Tom Hall. Stay tuned now for Here and Now. It's coming up next after the news at the top of the hour. Appreciate your listening. Have a great day.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.